Anything that you guys absolutely don't want to chat about?
No, I don't think so. Because we even talked about this before. We were like, we could talk about South Africa. We're willing to talk about aggression. It's a big thing, unfortunately. Definitely can talk about epilepsy. Sorry, I'm answering for you.
No, I'm trying to is there anything off catalog the table? And see if there's anything. I don't think so. No, we're pretty open when it comes to our personal life, our struggles, and I think we can only benefit people by being open and honest as possible, right? Like, anybody who listens to SYNGAP stories, there's no value in us sugarcoating things or hiding.
You know,
things.
I kind of agree, because even if it doesn't get as bad as any one person's or family's experience, and that people at CHOP are listening, you know, they know your family, they know you guys very well and your situation. But for other people who are treating our kids, I mean, they need to know the worst, ugly part of it too, because it is so important to how we live our lives.
For sure.
Hello and welcome to SYNGAP1 Stories, hosted by me, Ashley Fry. Every couple of weeks, I spread information and awareness about a rare disease that affects my son, Nathan. It's called SYNGAP1. I chat with parents, siblings, caregivers, and others about the challenges and successes of their journey with someone impacted by SYNGAP1. I hope you enjoy today's conversation.
Hello, everybody. Today, you have the pleasure of joining not one, but two guests, and you will likely know both of them by name, by face, and by all of the things that they have accomplished for SRF and for their son. And I am extremely, extremely excited about this upcoming conversation because it's going to be very real. It's going to be very raw. It's going to touch a lot of you in some good heartfelt places and in some pretty deep places as well. So I am very excited to introduce Sydney and Brett Stamalczyk. Did I say that right, you guys?
Close enough.
Please say it.
We're not particular about it.
Stamalczyk. Okay. Got it. They are currently living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Their son, Emmett, is 5. He's their SYNGAPian. Isaac is 12 and Judah is 10. They have an extremely interesting history in case road to diagnosis and then the odyssey and saga thereafter. So I kind of want to start there because most people we know of in the States who live here now haven't had the experience that this particular family has had. So you guys started out living in South Africa. So also, welcome. Hey.
Yay. Hello.
Okay. So yes, tell us about when you were living in South Africa and what led you to getting Emmett's diagnosis.
We made it to South Africa with our two oldest boys back in 2015 and realized on a trip to Cape Town in 2017 that we were pregnant with our third child. And Emmett was born later that year, which was super exciting, in Johannesburg. And for all we knew at the time when he was born, he was a perfectly healthy child.
No complications with pregnancy, nothing out of the ordinary. We had some struggles with our first son's pregnancy and our second son's pregnancy, but Emmett's pregnancy was just super smooth.
Yeah. And when he was born, like there were no problems at birth. Like it's so weird to sometimes think about how impacted by SYNGAP he is. And then to think that like he had a really great Apgar score, everything looked wonderful. And actually because we were in South Africa and because I had two healthy children, we didn't do any kind of newborn testing once he was born. And that unfortunately came back to be something that was really worrisome once we realized that he was experiencing global delay and everything. But yeah, healthy from the start.
And then as he grew up in South Africa, like we had to fly back to the States at one point when he was about 5 to 6 months old. And looking back, we've heard stories from so many other SYNGAP parents that it probably was one of the first symptoms we saw, which was he was just an unusually calm baby. He had no crying. We were on a flight from South Africa to Atlanta or New York. I can't remember, but it was 12 to 13 hours and he didn't cry at all. And we were driving all across the States. He was sitting in his car seat and he
was just happy,
just smiled and didn't really complain at all, which was highly unusual because we have two older neurotypical kids and they were incredibly expressive at that age.
Very needy. Yes. It was weird to have a kiddo who was so relaxed. And I thought to myself, like, oh, lucky me, the third time I can get a calmer kid. But I think actually while we were there in the States,
In 2018.
Yeah. So this was back in 2018. We were taking a couple months to come back home so we could meet everybody. And it was just dawning on me that, like, okay, he's not quite sitting up as much as the other two had at this point. He's not as interested in solid foods as the others two were at this point. He's got these kind of like weird sleep cycles and he wants to nurse all of the time more than the other two at this point. And it was just like, huh, this is different. So closer to the 9 month mark, we were back in South Africa again. And I was really starting to panic because I could tell that something was off with his developmental trajectory. And I actually had a friend in South Africa who had a baby, a son who was just like 3 weeks older than Emmett. And every time we would get together, I would just be like, what is going on here? Like, Emmett is not like developing these skills. So actually our first stop was my other child's occupational therapist was like, let me just kind of have a look at this kid. You know, what you're telling me is a little concerning. And she was like, he needs to go see like a physiotherapist. He needs to see an OT. Start there because he is behind. And then once we got there, of course, after a little while, they were like, we agree. He's really behind. Let's make sure you can get him in for an MRI. That was a whole thing. And then
this was in Johannesburg?
I think this was all in, Joburg and Pretoria. Okay. Yeah. I think one thing just really led to another. And around the 9 month mark is also when I started noticing his seizures. And we didn't know they were seizures at that point.
They just looked like weird blinking. It looked like, you know, if somebody gets dust in their eye, they're like trying to blink a lot to get it out. That's what it started as. And I mean, as I'm finding talking to many other SYNGAP parents, Sydney noticed all of the signs first. And I was like, I don't see it. I don't know what's going on. And I, you know, was fully on board with us pursuing, trying to find out about the delays and all of that. But I wasn't pursuing. We needed to get his seizures checked. But you definitely were. And it wasn't until after he had his first EEG, it was that next day that I saw his first seizure. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Like, it's not that I didn't believe you. I couldn't even understand what you were talking about.
Yeah. But I did feel absolutely bonkers because of that. Like, I was noticing these things about my kid. I really felt like something was off. Like, I was seriously just like melting internally like, over everything.
Even like going back so far to be like, did I take all of my prenatals when I was pregnant with him? And like just finding any logical explanation for why is he delayed and we haven't seen that before. And yeah, you very much struggled with that. And I think I tried my best to be a supportive husband during that time, but also like I don't think I was seeing the things as clearly as you were. And I think that I look back now realizing that I should have been more trusting of you. And I think that has helped me to love you better and to like give into your intuition a little bit more, especially when it comes to Emma.
So I'm going to say that was one of the sweetest, most genuine things I have heard in a really long time. And I know that Brett, you know, my husband, Kevin, you guys have spent a lot of time together, but like, can you please, you know, have a man to man talk about how he should talk to and about his wife? That'd be great.
Yeah, I'll make sure to drop on by Mississippi as we're on the cannibal on the way home.
We're gonna talk about that later.
It wasn't just you. Like, we started going down all of these paths trying to do testing for Emmett, kind of like anything that we thought could possibly be wrong. I remember on my desk, my work desk at home, I had a couple sheets of paper taped to the wall, and it was just like metabolic testing. All of these, you know, like all of these different things that I could possibly find on Google or whatever, we were going through them because unfortunately, or I mean, for better or for worse, we think Emmett is the first sub-Saharan diagnosis, or the first diagnosis of a person in sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, there's other Syngapians out there who don't have a diagnosis, or perhaps we just don't know about them, you know, yet. We haven't communicated with them. But, you know, nobody that we came into contact with, save one neurologist, had ever even heard of Syngap. So when MRI came back clean, when we finally found and paid for all of the metabolic testing and that came back clean, we were, you know, just going to anybody who would see us and asking them, what do you think? And finally, somebody who actually ended up being his neurologist for most of our time that we had left there was willing to give him an EEG. And what we, of course, didn't realize at the time was they were asking us to come in for what amounted to a 15-minute EEG,
right,
which is nothing in the course of 24 hours.
And they also had to sedate him first, which
we actually sedated him. We went to the pharmacy at the doctor's office and picked up the sedation drug.
Yeah, they refused to do it for whatever reason.
And gave him it orally.
Yes.
And then watched him fall asleep in our arms. And then would take him back to have the EEG done. And all of this sounds so crazy when I say it out loud now. But we didn't realize that when we were having him do that, none of the seizures were being caught in those 15 minutes while he was so heavily sedated. And we did this a couple of times before finally, one time they were like, oh yeah, there was the seizure.
I think they called it abnormal activity though. They weren't willing to classify it as a seizure at that point, which like a large part of our diagnostic odyssey in South Africa amounted to Sydney putting in all of the legwork and advocating for Emmett and us being wealthy enough in comparison to
the cost of
medical care in South Africa to not have to go through insurance, because typically you have to get referrals. And in our case, because we were paying out of pocket for literally everything, we got to refer ourselves. And so when Sydney had an idea, we got to pursue it. Whereas a lot of other people don't have that luxury because they either can't afford it or they have to go through their doctors to get the referral. Whereas like we were just straight up calling neurologists, et cetera, to like find out, hey, will you see us? What's your timeline? We'll pay cash. Like you don't have to worry about that. And that made it very difficult for us to like just know where to go because we were doing all the discovery.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the South African medical system is not as robust like in the public sector. And so a lot of times if you go to a clinic to have your kiddo seen, you could be waiting all day in the clinic for somebody to see you. You know, it's not like always on an appointment basis. And then getting a referral from there, you know, is just like another level of intensity with long wait times and, you know, just and professionals who haven't seen as many kids or really any kids maybe with Syngap.
Yeah. And so after the EEG, where there was finally some abnormal neurological behavior, we had to refer ourselves to the geneticist. Mm-hmm. Like the pediatric neurologist was like, you know, we can just kind of wait and see how he grows up. And we were like, no, we kind of need answers now. And we were like, what do you think about us going to get genetic testing? And he was like, I mean, I can't stop you.
He did write us a referral.
Yes.
And we did go see a genetic counselor. And at the time, there was pretty, if you were earning in the dollar, there was a way to get genetic testing rather quickly done either in the States or in Europe. And so this genetic counselor was amazing. She was so thorough. She was so knowledgeable. I am so thankful for her.
Like, we hear like Effie from Once Upon a Gene talks about like bad genetic counselor practices and bad like initial diagnoses. And I feel like I can't relate to any of that because our genetic counselor, like even looking back, was just like so on point of making sure, we'll get to it, but like making sure that we as parents were taken care of and we didn't leave that office with just a name. We left with resources and like a path forward.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So we had to find the genetic counselor. We had to suggest it to the neurologist.
Yeah.
We had to pay $250 to get my blood and Emmett's blood flown to America to Invitae.
That actually sounds so cheap for flying something.
Right? Yeah. Like, but when we found out it was $250, I was like, yeah, yes, let's just do it. Yeah. Like, if this can give us any answers, let's go ahead and just do it.
Yeah. And it happened to be Invitae's epilepsy
perfect
panel. And, you know, that's the unfortunate, but fortunate paradox of epilepsy is that that early onset epilepsy, you know, tends to get our patients earlier diagnoses. Hopefully that won't always be true, but for Emmett, it certainly was. And yeah, I think like 6 weeks later, I kind of like emailed her and was like, hey, are there any results? And she said, yes, but you have to come in to talk about it. And then I knew, of course, that that was really bad news. And we had already had suspicions that there was something genetic going on after so many things that we had done were not coming up with any kind of result for us. Yeah.
I remember thinking like we went through a number of diagnostic tests, MRIs, and when everything came back normal, I was like, well, that's good, right? He's just delayed. It's good. It's good. And Kevin was like, no, it means it's just harder to find and it's a whole lot rarer. Like I was a whole lot more in the dark than Kevin was at first, just understanding how bad it could be that everything, like we knew that there was a delay and something clearly was causing it. But I was like, well, it's good. They didn't find anything, right? Like he's normal. And Kevin was like, no.
I felt that way when stuff kept coming back normal. But I think especially when he had the epilepsy and the epilepsy for the first, like, I want to say 3.5 years of his life, and he's almost six now, that was really the battle to be fought, was trying to control his seizures and having any kind of quality of life with the medications that were required to do that. He went from those barely noticeable seizures that Brett described, which probably actually started around 6 or 7 months, to like, by the time he was one, just having hundreds and hundreds of seizures every single day. And not just eyelids, but like jerking, right? Like, I remember one time he was in a pram or
stroller.
Yeah. I'm thinking about South Africa. Like the cart at the store.
Trolley.
Grocery cart. Yeah. And he was sitting, you know, like how little kids sit in there with their legs hanging out. He had a seizure and it almost knocked him backwards over the back piece of the cart. Like it was so dramatic. And he would have those where his arms are jerking and he's like crying before they happen. And then he can't cry through them because they're like moving his upper body. And so like it went from so unnoticeable to extremely noticeable, and he wasn't on any meds at that time, like within
a couple months.
Yeah.
And like one of his big triggers is eating, like whatever the sensory experience of eating causes a lot of seizures. And we have so many videos of us feeding him food at 9 months old and him just like putting it in, enjoying the food, and then like having a violent jerking seizure because of it.
Yeah. So yeah, we got our diagnosis, and before we got our SYNGAP diagnosis, he had already been started on Depakote and I think Lamotrigine as well. Just because the seizures were really getting out of control, and we felt like we were kind of losing him, his abilities and his personality, and just everything didn't seem like it was going forward anymore.
Jeez. Wow. So at this point, when you have the SYNGAP diagnosis, how old is he?
About 19 months.
Okay. And your other boys, I mean, they're still young at this point too, right? I mean, so it's not only that you had a child, you were trying to desperately determine what was going on. You were parents of two young children in South Africa. I don't know how you guys did it.
We were, and we had foster children at the time as well.
Oh, right. Yeah. So this always happens when we tell our story, but I have mentally blocked out a lot of what went on during that time, because at the continuing thread over the last 4 or 5 years has been Emmett and his disease. But during the time of the diagnosis, we were going through some pretty heavy work conversations. I was growing my media company and my team there. We had foster children, one of whom had severe mental health struggles and had to be even removed from our home because we couldn't feel safe. And it was a whole, there was a lot going on, that I just block out, because I'm so, focused on Emmett and everything that's happened there.
That is true. He's definitely been, one of the key themes of life for the last 6 years. But yeah, it was hectic. And the older boys at the time, they were young. We had been homeschooling up until the point that Emmett started really having struggles with his epilepsy. And at that point, they started going to a Montessori school that was in our neighborhood. And that was actually really great for everybody because they got to experience school outside of the home for the first time, see their friends every day. And we both felt like we just had a little more space to take care of life since they were at school and we knew they were well taken care of. And then we focused on Emmett.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit. When and how did you guys decide to leave South Africa?
Yeah, we only need to fast forward by 2 weeks.
No, it was longer than that. I mean, not by much.
it was a long conversation of looking at the medical opportunities that were in South Africa, realizing that this is a lifelong disorder that we have to work through, and just really having some hard, heartfelt, are we supposed to be here in South Africa? Should we go back? What's the best thing for Emmett? What's the best thing for our family as a whole? And we came to the decision that we were going to move back to the States, but we were going to do it on a graceful timeline where we got to wrap up all of our loose ends. We got to come up with a plan of how I could run my company in two different continents and how we could, with Sydney's job, transition her role to other people. And then Emmett's seizures just exploded.
They spiraled out of control even further. And so actually he was on Depakote and Lamotrigine at the same time, which anybody else who has their kids on both of those drugs at the same time knows about this hectic rash that can break out and be life-threatening because of the two interacting. So it just so happens that Emmett got a pretty hectic rash during a time when our neurologist was out of the country. And so one of the really challenging things that we encountered was that a lot of specialists don't have a full nursing staff to answer calls and messages and to write prescriptions. It's like that doctor and their administrative person. So we found ourselves in a bit of a pickle and sent him some photos of the rash. And he was like, you've got to wean the Lamotrigine immediately. And anybody who has weaned drugs with a Syngaphian knows, you know, immediate weaning is a really bad plan. But we didn't know this yet. And in fact, I was kind of happy because even though we had added the second drug, his seizures just kept getting worse. Like they somehow were just getting more numerous and more violent. So we took this drug away quickly, and it's like unfathomable the amount of seizures that he started having. Like, I'm not even joking, like 10,000's too few in a day.
Yeah. And that was, so again, because our neurologist was not responding and like they wouldn't give us a proper EEG setup, we paid out of pocket for one at home.
I begged to be admitted to the hospital, but we for whatever reason, were not granted that. And yeah, he had an EEG at home and it was so bad that I was like, come back, take it off of him. We have to go to the hospital.
Because it was, I think, within the first hour, it was over 1,000.
Well, I don't think we got the counts from it on the at-home one. But...
No, the tech gave me like a readout. Yes. She was like, I've never seen this before. I don't even know how to process this number.
And the really crazy thing is, so we unhooked him. And by this point, it was clear that he was sick. He was sick from a viral rash, right? It wasn't the drugs, but nonetheless, he was sick.
And on top of that, we know a lot of Syngapians, they don't sweat. We didn't know Emmett couldn't sweat at this point. And it was hot. And South African houses don't have central air conditioning. And so he was just overheating a lot, too.
Yeah, like roasting because of his fever and having the thing on his head for the EEG. And then it was just like the perfect storm. So we got the piece off of his head. And one of my friends, who was also his nanny, we went to Johannesburg together. And actually, this is credit to Mike. He looked through his contacts, his network. I'm not even sure what he did. Maybe he Googled, but he was like, I think you should go see this person. And so we drove an hour to Johannesburg to present in the ER. And like, this is going to sound bananas, but they did not want to admit us because Syngap seizures are so cryptic sometimes. Like at that point, he was having just so many head drops, but they were just like a second long, and he would regain consciousness and he could like smile and do some like iPad activities, but they didn't want to admit us because they didn't think that he was having seizures. And then they hooked him up to the EEG and they're like, oh yeah, he's having a seizure every 5 seconds. Like, this is really serious. So that it was just like,
a lot of our South African story is like, we had to advocate for whatever it was, but we weren't well versed enough in what Syngap was, what this disease can take on forms as, to advocate properly. Yeah. And so we just basically had to beg, being like, no, please, please help us, because we know he needs help, but we don't know what to do.
Yes. And this certainly should not like sound like that South African medical care is not good. I think for the most part, we had really great care. The system's certainly different. In this one particular case, a neurologist being out of the country was incredibly dangerous for Emmett. And, you know, that can happen anywhere, anytime, whatever. But super credit to the neurologist that we did end up seeing at that hospital. She helped him to turn it around in about 10 days. It wasn't perfect, but he left in better shape than he got there in. And she had also read an article about Syngap recently in a magazine. So she was just really so sweet and so like understanding and so like persistent in helping us to get Emmett the things that he needed while he was there. And that was really, sorry, that was such a long way of saying, that's when we decided we needed to move back to the United States.
Immediately, yes.
Yes.
Jeez.
Yeah. So the recommendation at that point from that doctor was, I'm going to put him on brand new medication. We're going to get him stable. He's going to be stable for 2 weeks, and then you get out of here. And you go back to America to get actual American help.
Yep. And here's some drugs for the plane.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. It was really hectic and super traumatic. I like genuinely have PTSD from it.
Yeah, how can you not?
And I don't know. We came back to the States within 2 weeks and restarted in Florida. Emmett did.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
So it was incredibly sad.
But we did. How did you, went back to Florida. You guys were living in Gainesville? Is that right? Okay, I remember that correctly. Yeah. How did you decide to move to Gainesville?
That was where we were living prior to our move in South Africa. And that is where we had our largest social support network. And we also figured because the University of Florida is in Gainesville, they have Shands Hospital there, which is well regarded as, you know, a top research hospital. We were like, we don't have time to figure out anything right now. We just need to go somewhere. And we were like, let's go where we know, and we can go to Shands. We can drive to Orlando. We can drive to Jacksonville. We can drive to Tampa. We can go anywhere in the state of Florida that has resources. But we also know that like Gainesville actually is pretty well resourced as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And really like we, Gainesville was someplace that we knew. So we felt comfortable in a time of great distress and not knowing and feeling like life is crumbling and falling apart. And we knew that just by getting back to the States, we were going to have access to things simply because it is easier to get medical care in a country of which you are a citizen, right? Like there's just benefits to that system. And we had made it work in South Africa, but he just isn't a citizen. And, you know, that means that you don't have access to all of the same things. Anywhere. We were like, we're just coming back.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. So then I want to know a little bit about how he progressed over the next couple of years. Years when you guys were in Gainesville? When you were in Gainesville. Tell me that story.
Well, we moved back to Gainesville October, November of 2019.
Right before COVID.
Before COVID, when everything locked down. So, I mean, we had a few months to kind of establish our plan of care and meeting with doctors and understanding who we're going to see before the world got turned upside down. But, I mean, this, again, was another stage of us advocating for everything Emmett needed, but definitely more well-resourced now that we were connected with SRF. We connected with so many other parents, and we could understand what this was going to be for Emmett and for his life. And so
I think I have to stop you because you've reminded me of something. We haven't given proper credit to SRF so far, because the knowledge that we gained through the community, which of course we learned about SRF soon after Emmett's diagnosis in South Africa, was already in touch with Mike. I think SRF was like just a baby at that point, right? It's just been founded.
But we were also like immediately in contact with like Peter and Lindsay Halliburton. And like
the knowledge gained through even just the Facebook group and being able to have chats and messages with people also played into us making the decision to move, because it really helped us to get a grasp on, you know, how intense this disease can be. And it also helped us to realize, I think decently early on, that we were like, oh, we've got really bad epilepsy, right? Like it's like extraordinarily bad epilepsy. Yeah. And like, I'm so thankful that not everybody has epilepsy to that degree, but it did make me like think like, oh, like this is going to be harder than just, you know, one drug or even two drugs. And yes, it's proved to be harder than four drugs and keto and VNS at one time. And so that played into us being like, okay, like we're going to need to probably be back in the States so we can figure out, how do we afford this stuff? How do we find people who can help us answer the epilepsy questions? How do we get access to a larger spectrum of drugs? And then when we were in Florida, that's when we, you know, first got access to things like Epidiolex, and we also had access to Fintepla.
Which got, Epidiolex had just gotten approved by the governor of Florida like 2 months before we moved
thank
back.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like being a part of SRF also like helped us to make those drug decisions for Emmett, and to try things that other people had already tried and had success with, so that we weren't completely in the dark. And that's most of what our time in Gainesville was trying not to get COVID and ups and downs, terrible roller coaster ride of seizures and epilepsy meds. And then eventually SRF and the community through there is what led us to think about needing to leave Florida.
Well, it was that, and like, I don't want to shame anybody. But I do think
it's going to get interesting
because this is a portion of the diagnostic journey and the journey of, you know, taking care of our kids. Just because a doctor has a medical degree does not make them a good doctor.
Preach.
Yes.
It just means that they graduated and they got a job, which we saw so many neurologists in Florida where the response was either lack of effort, lack of investigation, communicating that our child was probably a little too complex for them, that they weren't going to be able to take care of him. And just a lot of searching for a doctor who has not just empathy for our situation, but also curiosity to investigate our situation. And then
shout out to Dr. Jimenez in the Miami area.
Yes.
Because he is one of those fabulous, fantastic doctors. Awesome.
Yes. He was just 7 hours away, which made it very difficult to go see him. But like finding a doctor who has empathy, curiosity, and then also, just the humility to admit that they don't know and that they're going to go out and find out for the sake of the patient apparently is very rare. Had no idea. You know, growing up, I only went to the doctor when I needed a physical, or if I had like a seriously bad cold. I had not experienced the depth of what specialists can do in like learning that even specialists like, you can be too out of pocket for them.
We did have people in Florida say, please don't come to us. Your kid's too complex. That happened a couple of times. And so, yeah, that's disappointing to hear, right? But by this point, we were very well aware that the goal was not going to be being seizure-free. It was going to be trying to balance the side effects of meds with the best seizure profile that we could possibly have and keeping that as stable as we could. So, yeah.
Yes, which was, we were in Florida for about 2 years. So it was a lot of back and forth with doctors and their nurses and trying to make med adjustments, and every 4 to 6 weeks documenting, oh, Emmett's seizures are getting worse again. What should we do? And then going through that, them changing something, him, Emmett being fine or leveling out on his seizures for 4 to 6 weeks, and then going downhill again, and us just like a perpetual cycle of Emmett getting to a plateau and then declining, and that plateau and then declining. And so that's a portion of it, but then also, over those 2 years is when his aggressive behaviors started to pop out here and there, which we got ABA therapy for, and we had an amazing therapist who Emmett really loved, and she really taught him a whole bunch of skills, but like, that was the first indication of like, this is going to be a journey beyond just medical issues. This is going to be a journey into learning how to survive in our home.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that summarize Florida for you nicely? It was terrible.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I have so many questions. Yes. Okay. So let's start with this. I happen to know what you guys I mean, a little bit about what you considered, how you thought about when you needed to leave Florida, where you were going to go. I was a witness to some of the conversations and questions you were asking of many of our SRF volunteers and community members, because you had at some point decided Florida is not the best place for our family and for Emmett's care long term. We need to make a smart move, and we're going to consider all of our options. And you were soliciting all kinds of information from everybody in every state in the US. So compared to the quick turnaround from South Africa to Florida, you guys spent a lot of time and consideration in your next move. So can you speak to that a little bit, and then how you landed on Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I'll start off by saying that we have the detriment and the absolute privilege of we are self-employed. And so our jobs go with us, and we are not tied down by that. Our insurance is not tied to our physical location. It's just tied to, can we pay the bill every single month? So we have the privileged opportunity to even investigate this. Additionally, we had already done an international move where we expatriated. And so losing our support structure of friends and family was already a known entity for us. And we knew we could survive that. And we knew that we could build a new life somewhere else. So we had these basic foundations that made it so that we could even entertain, okay, we can move anywhere in the world. As long as we can afford it, we can move there. So let's really find out, because we're not tied down by our jobs, because we have family who will come to visit us and we know how to like start again in a new city. Let's start asking a bunch of relevant questions to take care of Emmett, not just now, but set him up so that he's good for the rest of his life, which is not possible, but like that was the foundation of everything we were doing.
Yes. There were lots of Google searches, lots of talking to other parents and Excel spreadsheets that helped us try to figure out, does this state have some kind of medical assistance for people with disabilities? In Florida, unfortunately, the answer is no.
Once they pass 5 years old, if you are not below the poverty line, you qualify for no assistance, and you get kicked out of programs that you can pay for, which was one of there's so many like small things that like we ran into.
Yeah. I just want to say too, like, but it's incredibly like, you know, it's like individualized. Mm-hmm. So if people are living in Florida or want to live in Florida, you know, you have to, this is just our situation. Yours could be potentially different, but, In Pittsburgh, well, in Pennsylvania, if you can prove that you have a chronic disability that meets their criteria, it doesn't matter what your income is, you qualify for medical assistance. And for us, that was really important, because for the limited time while we were living in Florida, when we did have medical assistance for Emmett when he was under five, I saw what those bills looked like, and I was terrified. And, you know, knowing the limits of a lot of our insurance carriers, like the, you know, the big ones, they don't pay for a lot of stuff that people with disabilities need. And Emmett takes really expensive medications, and he needs durable medical equipment in order to be safe and to thrive. He also needs, in my opinion, a very specialized school setting, and we didn't have access to that either. So kind of the culmination of things was, we knew he could get medical assistance and it wouldn't be based on our income. We knew that he would have access to really good private specialized schools if we moved to the right school district, which thankfully we did. And it was also a good school district for our other children. And Pittsburgh is a relatively well-priced city.
You're starting at the end, though, right? Like the investigative criteria were like insurance.
Yeah.
Could we cover that? we weren't really thinking about school so much because we were also asking the questions about ABA. About what does that coverage look like with those insurances? What if he just had behavior therapy 30 to 40 hours a week, which he absolutely qualifies for? What does that look like? Additionally, access to pediatric neurologists who not only know what SYNGAP is, but have seen SYNGAP patients before. That was also a big criteria. So
you're looking at maybe like six cities in the U.S.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we could afford this one, so we moved here.
Yes, cost of living was also one of one of the factors.
Yeah, and I can imagine too, like tax considerations as self-employed individuals too. Like that would have been a big consideration for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the cost of living factored all of that in there, but like I'm personally of the mindset of like, I'll pay whatever taxes I need to get Emmett the care that he needs.
We feel like our kid uses his tax dollars. So.
Yeah, but like also just like running up to the limits of systems in places like Florida, I realized I couldn't even buy my way into getting him the care he needed because of the medical system, the insurance system. They have all these rules and things set up that if you come in as a private payer and you're not like obscenely wealthy, like you don't get any sort of head nod because they're used to dealing with the insurances and they can't trust that you're actually going to pay your bills. And like it all just like adds to the like, oh, we need to leave this state and find somewhere else that's actually going to work for us.
So I want to go back to the other symptoms of SYNGAP that Emmett experiences. So we talked about his severe and devastating epilepsy, and you mentioned his aggression when he was in Florida. Do you guys want to expand on that?
Yeah. So the first I can remember noticing his aggression, it may have started earlier than this. There were just like small moments when he was sitting in his high chair as a 2-year-old. And he would be happy, eating his food, laughing with mom, and he would make eye contact with me, and he would stop being happy and start screaming and trying to grab at me and attack me. And I was like, okay, I did something to make this kid very angry. I don't know what's going on here. And that thankfully, due to the help of our amazing therapist, like we work through that and how like I can approach him in a way that he can receive it. But like there's just these moments that I was seeing where like it was triggers that just naturally happen that would start to get him to act out.
Yeah. And I think over time, it's just what started really small has evolved into much more challenging behaviors. So I can remember when Emmett was like 9 months old, he's a big chunky baby. I would wear him around everywhere and he would gnaw, like not an aggressive way, but he would just gnaw on my shoulder, like biting it to the point that I would have bruises. And as time went on, like he would lash out and like bite people on the hand or bite people on the arm when he didn't like something or when access was denied to something. And then it would just start happening more frequently and be more aggressive. And then we would see him biting himself. And, you know, now we're at the point where we unfortunately have head banging that has started like on the floor. Self-injurious behavior like biting the knees and his arms happens every single day almost.
Which leaves bruises. And
yeah, which leaves bruises on him. It hurts him. But then we have so many things that he will do to family members, all of us really, from hair pulling to pinching to biting. And it's just gotten worse over time. Like it is really like such a puzzling thing because like Brett and I don't use corporal punishment on our children. And so it's like this really weird thing that you're like, well, you didn't learn it from me, like, but this like came out of somewhere, somehow you know, like you learned that you either you feel better when you do this. This is calming for you. You know, maybe sometimes you get what you want because you do this. I don't know what, you know, I don't even know if they know exactly why that is something that just continues to repeat itself, but it certainly has. And, you know, now sometimes when we're in really bad seasons, like if meds are off or we've made a change, especially over summer when the change was that school wasn't in as usual, we would have days when Emmett would like get up, come across the room to really come after you, to bite you, like, to hit his head on the floor.
In an act of intentional aggression due to some event that happened that he was either displeased with or like
felt threatened by, overwhelmed by,
it was anxious because of. And that's like, that has been the hardest daily part of Emmett's like journey right now, is just figuring out, number one, how do we protect him? Number two, how do we protect ourselves? Number three, how do we understand exactly what it is that is causing him to react so viscerally and violently to the world? And like Sydney mentioned, you know, bad days over the summer because of med changes and lack of school. But then even on like days where I think things are going really well, I get him ready for school. I feed him breakfast. Everything's going fine. We're laughing. We're watching the iPad. And then I go to put him in our minivan to get him to school. And as I'm buckling him in, he bites the top of my head and starts screaming at me. And this is a routine we've done so many times. I haven't had a problem with it in months. And then all of a sudden, I'm now highly on guard again of, oh, I can't ever just presume everything's okay. I have to be watching every single stimuli he's taking in order to understand, is he okay with this or not? How do I protect myself or not? I left myself vulnerable. I got hurt, but I want to find a way where like we make the world happy for him, but also like,
yeah,
it's a very tough challenge.
I remember something that Peter said a while ago was like, you're just kind of on hyper alert all the time. And as soon as you're not, the other shoe's going to drop, no matter what that looks like, but something will happen that like puts you back on hyper alertness. And it's just so exhausting. It's exhausting to anticipate. It's exhausting to deal with in the moment. And then to reassure yourself that you didn't do anything wrong to cause any of this or the outcomes, but it's just kind of part of SYNGAP life. So I feel for you guys, because I know that it's not easy and you guys have a pretty severe case on your hands.
It's a really big mental exercise, I think, that all of us go through, where you have to like train yourself and encourage yourself, because this is your child. Of course you love them, but you really have to look past so much of the behavior to remember that person mm-hmm. that's in there, right? Like experiencing all of this, they're having hard things going on in their mm-hmm. brain chemically and otherwise, and loving right. them, right? Your yeah. brain gets used to loving this person and wanting the best for them and looking past all of the really hard behaviors.
I would disagree with the language of looking past it. I think the way I cope with it is I look directly at it and I'm like, this isn't Emmett. Mm. This is the fact that he is missing half of the SYNGAP right. protein that he needs. This is not my kid. This yeah. is mm-hmm. the disease. And I need to work through this moment to get back to yeah. my kid. And like, I feel like we've spent a lot of time talking about the negatives of the journey, but like, I also just want to take a moment to pause and be like, we love Emmett.
Yeah.
And not like, he's an amazing kid. He is happy. He enjoys so many things. It's lovely to watch him grow up and learn skills and like Like, he's going to become a man one day who has been through more difficulty and challenge than I ever have, and probably will still smile. And that, like, that amount of, like, he goes through so much therapy every single week, and he still does it, and he still, like, can be happy at the end of it. And, like, just the amount of grit and determination that our kids have to go through the hardships that they have, like, to have 10,000 seizures in a given day and then still smile back at you when you smile at them. Like, he is amazing, and we love him, and we, like, all of this is in the context of that.
Yeah. Well, very said. Well said. Well said. Okay, so before I ruin it by crying, I want to know, well, I want to share out loud for anybody who doesn't know how you guys have volunteered with SRF over the years. I want to talk about how you have participated and some of the things that bring you joy with this community. Sydney, let's start with you.
I don't feel like I've really done that much.
You've been on
Mike even said this in a Syngap pit.
You're like a heroine here.
I love connecting with new families. I try to limit myself to only connecting with people if they have really severe epilepsy and need help, or if they are maybe trying to start keto and need help, or if they're in my area and they've just got diagnosed, then I try really hard to make sure I connect with all of those people, because otherwise I would just do that all the time. But I like connecting with them, and obviously sharing our medication experiences, I think, has been very helpful, hopefully, to some. I am helping us to kind of coordinate our back and forth with the CHOP team. So we didn't know when we moved to Pittsburgh that the team at CHOP was going to get a ridiculous, an amazingly ridiculous amount of money to study SYNGAP. And so I feel like we won the lottery when we came to Pennsylvania.
I mean, part of it was we knew we were going to have access to CHOP. We just had no idea they were going to be.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm helping with, you know, making sure that our patients have access to all the information they need to successfully participate in that study. And the cannonball is really Brett's story, so I'll let him talk about that.
And before you get into it, Brett, I want to share with everybody that we will post lots of links for Emmett's story and blogs that we have done, news that we have had about both him and the CHOP and the END study. We're going to post all of the links to that and to past and upcoming cannonballs. So Brett, take it away.
Yeah, so I, oddly enough, just have a YouTube channel that has a significant number of followers, and I always built it on the foundation that I wanted to give back to the community, so we always did annual charity events where we raised money in South Africa for orphan and vulnerable children, and then once Emmett got his diagnosis, I was like, oh, well, I'll just transition this to raise money for SRF and for SYNGAP research, and that led to me trying to one-up myself every single year till we got to the first cannonball in 2021, which I was watching some other YouTuber who was trying to set the world record for an electric cannonball run. And I was like, what if I live stream it and we just broadcast it to the world and we don't try to set any records. We just try to have fun and make it about raising money for our kids and tying it in, you know, with the latest technologies, because that's what it's going to take to get some sort of treatment for our kids. Like, let me do that. And oddly enough, it was a way bigger success than I ever thought it could have been. I was so nervous that first year. That was when I met your husband for the first time, like the night before the event, when he agreed to drive for 60 hours across the entire United States with me without showering or sleeping. And we raised $150,000 for SYNGAP Research Fund, which I just, like, doesn't even make sense to me. We were just being goofy guys on the internet. And but, like, the story of, you know, what Sydney and I have gone through, what SYNGAP families have gone through resonates with people. And I think people are willing to join in on a good story and lots of fun. And so that's what I try to provide for them. And we're doing it again this year in less than a month.
So this is going to be October 4th.
Clear your viewing schedules.
So this is the third annual Cannonball Run. What is different about this year than the past 2 years?
That is a question I wrestle with every single year. We are doing it in an electric truck this time, as opposed to just a regular SUV. So we're going to have
a little more leg space,
a lot more space. So a lot more space for keeping things in the truck, in the frunk, in the truck bed, like more relaxed in that regard. But also, like, I think one of the things I look at other long term social media creators who raise a lot of money for charity, and the thing that they do is they don't raise more money every year by getting more ridiculous. They raise more money every year by being consistent and just continuing to further tell the story and bring people into the community. And so I've spent my last year growing my channel as much as possible, and I'm hoping that results in more people coming in and donating so that we can get treatment for our kids.
And we forgot, well, we haven't mentioned yet that there's two new drivers this year.
There are. Yeah. We have our first international participant. That's as correct. Well as our first mother of a SYNGAP.
Brave SYNGAP woman.
Child. Yes. I selfishly am jealous that I am not the first mom driver, but it's fine. I will let I will let the glorious Monica Harding have all of all of that fame and joy.
And there's hopefully always next year, right? Like,
yeah. I will not rule it out.
I think that
if certain things hadn't gone the way they went this year, this
only opens the door for more moms.
Yeah. This year I'm just conditionally not available, but yes.
Well, your husband, who has been at part of the last two, told me right before we departed ways after the second one, I will not be coming back unless it's in an electric truck. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to have one. And then we got it. Like, and he's also jealous that he's not going to be participating.
Oh, he for sure is. He was like, oh, I want to drive this truck. Anyway. And he was like, man, I wish I could go now. I was like, dude, you missed the boat. You waited too long. But I know you guys will also agree. Monica is going to be a fabulous upgrade from Kevin.
Super exciting.
No, I, Kevin, actually. I will defend Kevin till my dying breath. That man.
I remember Brett came home from the first Cannonball and he goes, Kevin is just lovely.
I love your husband.
Much time with him.
He knows who he is. He has a very direct way about him that's not harsh. It's very soft, and like, he has a lot of compassion and empathy, but also like a lot of principles. And like, I highly respect that. And when my job is being a goober on the internet and your husband is like just the straight man, it like it played so well for me that I will
You're
not
gonna miss him.
We I will. Miss you, I'm Kevin. Gonna miss Kevin, but I also will not abide anybody saying that it's an upgrade to not have Kevin.
Okay.
Yeah, Monica is gonna be fantastic.
I also agree.
Okay, so what are you most looking forward to, and what are you least looking forward to for the Cannonball?
Most looking forward to the community building. It's just amazing to see so many people from so many walks of life. So many people who have never met our children advocating for them and sacrificing to donate to SRF. Like, it brings me to tears every single year. The thing that I'm least looking forward to.
The maple spin, maybe?
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, let's not spoil everything. Yeah, we have some creative community members who are sending in disgusting foods for us, and I'm not looking forward to eating cold maple spam because we're not gonna heat it up.
Oh man! Well, it is going to be a trip.
But maybe it's just the sleeplessness, hey?
Yeah, I've gotten used to it, especially having a Singapian where like they don't sleep every night. Like I feel like I'm uniquely just positioned to do this.
Yeah, you have a very good point there. Remind us when that live stream and event is going to happen.
So it's going to be taking place October 4th through 6th. It's going to be on YouTube and Twitch. You can find it by searching UFD Tech or going to singap.fund/cball, I believe, is the shortened link for that.
We also have a hashtag, which will bring up everything, right? Hashtag UFD.
Cure. Awesome. Yes. We're going to put links to it for sure. And if any of you have watched previous years, I highly recommend, if you haven't already, to subscribe to Brett's channel on Twitch, because it's a fabulous platform for watching all of this. And even after the Cannonball is over, I would check in with you as you're driving yourself back to Pittsburgh. but every once in a while, even though, you know, the content on your channel is way over my head, I will like log in and tune in and check out what's going on and like maybe say, hey, Brett, in the chat.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, highly recommend subscribing to his channel as well. It's a wonderful platform. All right. One thing that I love to end with is any advice or recommendations for SynGap families on how to live a happier life with SynGap?
Don't wonder what it could have been like otherwise. Focus on who they are and the parts of them that are still reflective of who you know them to be.
That's good.
That's good advice. Yeah, I think it's good to just remind ourselves always that there's a lot of ways to be human, right? And you know, when you have your own little humans, you're just not in charge of everything that they go through. And, you know, as we're finding out, you're not in charge of their health, even if you yourself are relatively healthy. I don't like the pain that comes with being a SynGap parent. The pain and the grief can be really overwhelming. But I genuinely feel we are all more loving people, appreciative of other people's humanity. And, I just, maybe we don't appreciate that enough, right? Like what we learn from them, the things that they teach us. I don't think that we would learn these things any other way. And this is our life. So it is our privilege to learn these lessons while we're going through it.
Oh my gosh, both of you. That was so, so well said. Well, I know how busy your lives are and how difficult it can be to share any amount of time away from your family, and that you are both sitting with me this evening is a testament to your character and your constant willingness to give to the community and share your story. So thank you both so, so much.
Thanks for having us, Ashley.
All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. We will chat with you soon.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and like us wherever you're listening. For more information about today's guest and SynGap One, please check out our show notes. Your suggestions are always welcome. Please email us at ed@curesyngap1.org.